Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Greetings to all of our viewers and listeners from around the world. Good evening from Moscow. Good morning or good afternoon from wherever else you are. Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to have you all for another great episode here at DD Geopolitics. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm good. I can't keep up with the news cycle. I can't.
I feel like if you sleep, you'll miss something.
I slept a lot last night. I missed a lot, apparently.
We are definitely becoming insomniacs slowly.
Yes.
Well, we have a great guest for everyone today, which is good. That will hopefully get people excited. Of course, it's a guest that I'm very close to, longtime comrade, traveled to Lugansk People's Republic with last year, presented at the UN with, have been at numerous events with. So let's welcome Dan Kovalik. There he is.
Hey. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're honored to have you here.
Thank you.
Dan, of course, for those who don't know, is a human rights attorney, a labor rights advocate, and one of the most fearless voices exposing U.S. foreign policy hypocrisy. Dan spent decades with the United Steelworkers and has taught international human rights law at the University of Pittsburgh. Now, just ahead of its October 1st release, his latest book, Syria, Anatomy of Regime Change, co-authored with Jeremy Kuzmarov, and featuring a foreword by Oliver Stone, offers the first comprehensive account of the decades-long U.S. operation to destabilize Syria, dismantle its nationalist project, and install a Western-aligned proxy regime. Dan, thank you so much for being here. Let's get into it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. By the way, you mentioned the steelworkers. I have to mention my former boss, former president of Steelworkers, Leo Gerard, pretty good guy, just passed away 2 days ago. So that's kind of big news here for us.
Our condolences and sympathies, and his struggle will continue. Of course,
Thank
a struggle
you.
Of labor, a struggle of workers' rights. So we continue that. Dan, your new book, Syria, Anatomy of Regime Change. And of course, as you know, you and I have been to Syria.
Yes.
You've been there on a few delegations, and I was there, of course, fighting against
us. Yes. Oh,
we were both there in different capacities. So this book, which you co-wrote with Jeremy Kuzmarov, who, by the way, you can find at Covert Action Magazine, and I want to put a plug in for that. I published there. I know Dan's published there. So
yes.
Check it out. Oliver Stone wrote the foreword to the book, which is always a good sign. And it really comes at a critical moment for all of us, I think, just months after the fall of Damascus and the installation of an al-Qaeda-linked regime. What compelled you, number one, to write this book now? And how important was it to push back on the dominant media narratives that paints this regime change as quote-unquote liberation? And how does this book connect with your broader body of work on U.S. regime change wars, like in Venezuela or Iraq, or even, for example, with Iran and Russia in the crosshairs?
Yes. Well, I mean, what really spurred it on was the fact that this regime change operation became successful in December 2024 with the coup, I guess you could call it, that overthrew President Bashar al-Assad. The group, which had been the al-Nusra Front of al-Qaeda, just renamed itself HTS, took over Syria in a fairly – without very much resistance. We can get into why that was. But essentially, it was the culmination, as you say, of many years of regime change efforts by not just the United States, but a number of allied and semi-allied nations. This really was a world war against Syria, which, again, you're not going to learn about this in your high school social studies class. But the ambassador, Assad's ambassador to the UN at one point said they collected amongst the fighters, those fighting to overthrow Assad, they collected passports from 101 different countries. That's over half the countries of the world had some involvement in overthrowing Assad, you know. So the odds are always stacked against the government and the people of Syria. And again, ultimately, they were worn down by years of war, by terror, sanctions. And now you have al-Qaeda, let's call it what it is, you know, as the rulers of Syria, and the head of al-Qaeda and the self-proclaimed president, as we speak, 13 days after September 11th, is in New York City walking the streets free at large. It's just, you couldn't make this up. If you wrote a novel with this as the plot, no, everyone would say this is outlandish, right? But this is the reality. So.
Well, my viewers know I'm a clip junkie. I love to show my guests clips and kind of get their feedback. But yesterday was a really big day in the UN. Usually I don't even pay attention to what's going on there. But in addition to Britain, Canada, Australia, Portugal, we now have France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Malta, Monaco, a whole other slew. I think the total is now 157 countries now recognize Palestine. This is my favorite of the speeches.
Whilst the recognition of a Palestinian state is urgent, it is all the more urgent that there exist a Palestinian people in the state that we're claiming to recognise, and regrettably the Palestinian people are being annihilated. For this reason, in the name of reason, in the name of international law, and in the name of human dignity, we have to stop this slaughter now. At this precise moment, bombs continue to fall indiscriminately on the civilian population in Gaza. Hunger is killing women, older persons, and children. Today, we take a crucial step forward in calling for a two-state solution at this conference. But let us be lucidly clear, there is no solution possible when the population of one of those two states is the victim of a genocide. We are all well aware that the only hope that civilians in Gaza have is that of knowing that the world does not forget them. And this conference
is un acto de rebeldía.
Is an act of moral rebellion and uprising against indifference and forgetfulness. Let us make this conference too a collective commitment to halting brutality and to paving the way for peace. Excellencies, this conference marks a monumental step forward, but it is not the end of the road. It only is and can only be the beginning. As such,
so you're a human rights lawyer. In your honest opinion, is this wave of recognition at the UN an actual step towards self-determination, or is it just more performative diplomacy? I picked Spain because Spain has been sort of this one of the points of the spear in the EU, sort of pushing back against Israel. And just as an aside, Spain and Italy both launched military ships today to protect the flotilla heading to Gaza.
So. I saw that, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think those folks on the flotilla represent the best of humanity.
Yeah, we spoke to them last night while they were being attacked. It was pretty intense, but they're all okay.
They're beautiful people. Well, I think it's largely performative, which doesn't exclude it also having some value. I think the Western countries that are now recognizing Palestine are essentially, you know, trying to now realize there's no way to deny what's happening, that there is a genocide that they did deny. They tried to deny it as long as they can. They can't anymore. So to save their own reputations and maybe their own skin, to save themselves from going to The Hague at some point, they've recognized Palestine. Now, again, that doesn't mean that that doesn't have value. It does. I'm sure Israel, by the way, is furious about this. Yeah. I'm certain of that. And frightened by it. I mean, when you do something like recognize Palestine, whether you do it half-heartedly or not, it has a meaning, right? And it will require action at some point. Now, will that be in time to save Gaza? I don't know. You know, obviously we need much more than words. We need, you know, in my own view, probably some sort of military intervention to protect the people of Gaza, plus, you know, much more humanitarian aid, not just by civilian flotillas, but, you know, by major state actors to save these people from famine. But again, this could be the beginning of that. I do think this spells the, you know, the end of Israel as we know it. I think Israel knows that, too. But as Churchill said at one point, this is not the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning, right? I mean, I think that, you know, it's going to take time. There's going to be a lot more bloodshed. But yeah, the fact that Spain and Italy are sending these armadas to defend the flotilla, that's action, that's something. And I think it will be the beginning of something important. I think it also, I mean, by the way, I think this is going to have reverberations way beyond Palestine. I think the EU is going to fall apart over this. NATO is going to fall apart over this. The West has lost all legitimacy in the eyes of the world. All their talk about democracy and freedom and human rights died on the shoals of Gaza.
Yeah.
And there will be a reckoning at some point.
Well, Bibi Yitzhak, he said, this is a quote, a Palestinian state will not be established west of the Jordan. We doubled Jewish settlement in the West Bank, and we will continue on this path. The response to the latest attempt to impose on us a terror state will be given after my return from the United States. Wait for it.
Yeah, well, you know, Netanyahu is doubling down. He is carrying out the final solution, right? He is like Hitler in the bunker, right? The Holocaust was sped up as Nazi Germany was losing to the heroic Soviet Union. And the genocide is speeding up as Israel is facing its defeat. And again, before October 7th, 2023, I would never use such a term. Final solution, you know, to say what Israel was doing in Palestine or to compare what's happening in Palestine to the Holocaust. But I think at this point, again, those comparisons are inevitable. Reality demands those comparisons. And of course, there are Holocaust survivors making those comparisons. So, and well, you know, who's been writing some great stuff on this is Chris Hedges, you know, yeah. And he says that, yeah, you know, the new Holocaust deniers are the people denying that what's happening in Gaza is a Holocaust. And he includes in that the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, there's some, really profound and fascinating realizations that many of us have come to, you know, because of what's happening in Gaza. Some I'm even, you know, wary to articulate, you know, but, you know, I think this idea that we were taught for so long that never again, we thought that meant never again for everyone, but we now know that's not true. Mm. Right? And yeah, I mean, I can only say that is knowledgeable as I think I am, and you know, as wise as I think I am with my gray hair, I've learned some very brutal truths since October 7th. You know, And I look back in retrospect on things, again, that I thought I understood, and I realize I've been misled. And that's heavy stuff. That's heavy stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are coming to that realization.
Mm.
Let's bring some levity. Well, maybe not, but I always laugh at Trump no matter what he says. But here's Trump at the UN.
As everyone knows, I have also been deeply engaged in seeking a ceasefire in Gaza. Have to get that done. Have to get it done. Unfortunately, Hamas has repeatedly rejected reasonable offers to make peace. We can't forget October 7th, can we? Now, as if to encourage continued conflict, some of this body is seeking to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state. The rewards would be too great for Hamas terrorists for their atrocities. This would be a reward for these horrible atrocities, including October 7th, even while they refuse to release the hostages. Or
want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Accept a ceasefire. Instead of giving to Hamas and giving so much, because they've taken so much, they have taken so much. This could have been solved so long ago. But instead of giving in to Hamas's ransom demands, those who want peace should be united with one message. Release the hostages now. Just release the hostages now.
I'm in the camp that believes there's no hostages, or that that's not even an issue. But this comes like a few days after the straight up veto of the ceasefire by the United States.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, I mean, this is just, you know, these are just, he's just spouting lies, of course. Although I give him credit, he was fairly articulate. He sounded pretty good for Trump, actually. But despite my disagreement with the content of his speech.
Well, this came out today as well. So keeping this in mind, like, it's just one, we just blow with the wind. Sorry, it says Trump promises Arab leaders he won't let Israel annex the West Bank.
No, this guy changes his ideas, you know, as much as most of us change our underwear. I mean, it's just incredible. But so what can be said? I mean, you know, I think the most recent ceasefire deal that looked like it could have materialized, Hamas actually agreed to the terms that Benjamin Netanyahu had come up with. And then Netanyahu said, ah, forget about it. You know, I mean, there is nothing Hamas could do to end this war. Let's face it, nothing. Because Netanyahu doesn't want the genocide to end. He wants the final solution. He wants to eradicate every man, woman, and child in Gaza. And he's come very close so far. I mean, the latest, I think, honest estimate I saw was 680,000 Gazans killed already. Out of 2.3 million. I mean, do the math. That's almost a third of the population. And counting. And that, sadly, that number's going to accelerate quickly because of the famine and disease. All these even weird diseases that were dead are coming back. And even you saw Israeli soldiers are coming back with weird skin diseases from southern Gaza, because, you know, when people are malnourished, don't have clean water, disease spreads like wildfire. And that's exactly what's happening. So, and, you know, this was discussed at least a month ago, if not more, that even if you brought in all the food people could eat right now, they would die, right? There's something called, what is it?
Refeeding syndrome.
Thank you. Refeeding syndrome. You can't just start feeding people who are starving. You will kill them. And so, you know, easily, and I hate to make this prediction, but easily half the people in Gaza will be killed. I mean, I'm sorry to say, but I mean, that's probably a minimum. And again, unless this is stopped now, Netanyahu will get what he wants, and that is a land without a people. All right. Now, that was the lie, of course, that Israel was built on, a land without a people for a people without a land. That wasn't true because the Palestinians were on the land. But they may make that lie a truth in Gaza. And that's horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
Trump also said this. We'll get Chris's reaction.
You have to end it now. See, I can tell you. I'm really good at this stuff. Your countries are going to hell. In America, we've taken bold action to swiftly shut down uncontrolled migration.
Maybe the United States is going to hell, and they should look internally about that before they start hurling accusations.
I'm really good at this stuff. I'm really good at this stuff.
Yeah, no, that's – yeah, and it's insane. I mean, the idea that Trump is doing anything to help America, I mean – America is sinking like a stone, mostly because, you know, the only thing Trump is spending money on is the military and ICE. It's just all about beating people up. I'm sorry. You know, the infrastructure is falling apart. The cities are falling apart. People are slipping. Working people are slipping into homelessness in mass numbers. We are a third world country now. And actually that is probably giving too much credit to the U.S. You know, there's third world countries I'd rather live in than here. And I'm being totally serious about that. You know, I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and, you know, just the last few days, just walking the streets. I live downtown. I mean, the, you know, amount of homelessness is just increasing to, you know, to a point I've never seen before. And roads. I'll just give one example. I live right on Fifth Avenue here, which I can see out my window, which is a main vein of Pittsburgh. It's been under construction for about 4 years, almost totally impassable. They say the construction will be completed by 2027. So two more years. Wow. I mean, and I always joke, if this were China, they would have had it done
overnight.
In 6 weeks.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, but this is a joke. It's a joke. I mean, well, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And again, this is reproduced all over the country. So, and the violence you're seeing in this country, the school shootings and,
assassination attempts.
Political violence. You know, it's just stunning. It's stunning. And again, I don't know. It is that, you know, the frog in the boiling water thing where, you know, it's happened, you know, in a way so gradually over time that now Americans are almost inured to it. Like, this is just our lives now, you know. In other countries, well, you're seeing this in Italy. They're in Paris. I mean, they're tearing those places down. They're so angry. And you're not seeing that in the U.S. You're not, and it's worse here. And you're not seeing that sort of public outcry and protest. I think, again, the Americans are just like, this is just how it is. They're resigned to it. But also, I think they feel so demoralized. They feel like they can't do anything about it. I mean, because they realize that the system's rigged. It's rigged. The political system's rigged. So it's, you know, we're left grinding and gnashing our teeth. But I've probably gone off topic. But I mean, yeah, but the idea that Trump is somehow, oh, doing better for his people than Europe is, I mean, it's just a joke. They're both failing their people miserably.
Miserably.
Speaking of bullies and failures, and so I'm going to move over to Tom Barrack, who, just so our viewers know, Tom Barrack is a billionaire investor, longtime Trump friend. He chaired Trump's 2017 inauguration, and then he was indicted in 2021 for being an unregistered agent of the UAE and then acquitted and then hired by Trump. So this is Tom Barrack, in a recent interview with The National, actually. It's The National News, which is a UAE-sponsored. Here's some highlights.
Talking about the left disarming Hezbollah.
It's the only people who are there. So LAF being mostly Sunnis, there are Shias, and it's a good organization. It's well-meaning, but it's not well-equipped. Because who are they going to fight? Right, we don't want to arm them. We're going to arm them so they can fight Israel? I don't think so. So you're arming them so they can fight their own people, the Hezbollah. I would say the Lebanese, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, because all they do is talk. There's never been one act. We've told them, do you want our help? We'll give you our help. We gave them a playbook. They can't get there. If we talk about trust, quite honestly, in this business, I don't trust any of them. Our interests are not aligned. Ally is a mistaken word. Our interests are not aligned.
With the Syrian regime?
No, with any of them. With any of them in the Middle East.
Including Israel?
Absolutely.
And Missy's arming them to fight their own, to kill their own people, calls it a business. What are you guys' thoughts? You guys are both have extensive experience in West Asia.
Yeah, I mean, this is a U.S. foreign policy in West Asia. I mean, it is to destroy these countries. And I've been giving a lot of thought to that because a lot of people ask, why? Why would you do that? Why would you destroy Syria? Why would you destroy Lebanon? These are countries with incredible histories, including Muslim histories, Christian histories. Why would you do this? And of course, you know, oil's always one answer to that. You know, they, you know, the U.S. wants the oil. This is the Jimmy Carter doctrine, right? Who extended the Monroe Doctrine to the Persian Gulf, said the U.S. can intervene in the Persian Gulf anytime to protect its oil interests there. But it's beyond that. You know, I was thinking about the Enclosure Act. In Great Britain in the 18th and 17th century as capitalism is taking hold. And so there it used to be that in Great Britain that properties were held in common, right? And people farmed and they raised sheep and other livestock on this common land that no one owned. So the Enclosure Act was passed to kill that. This was anathema to capitalism. So they fenced in, you know, made the communal land, subdivided it into smaller plots that were privately owned and killed the communal property. Now, how does that relate to a place like Syria or Lebanon? These are countries with more traditional societies that even up till recently, again, people lived more cooperatively, had more of a social values that were based in the mosques or the churches. And again, like the common land in Great Britain that needed to be killed by the capitalists, by the Enclosure Acts, I believe that the powers that be see these traditional societies as anathema to Western capitalism, and that they need to crush those traditional societies and turn the land into, again, private areas that can be used for profit and turn the people into consumers. Mm-hmm. And so this is a violent process that is taking place to make that happen. I mean, it's really disgusting, you know. And so in Syria, what's happened, and it's been going on since 2011 when the U.S. and others started supporting al-Qaeda and ISIS, those groups already started destroying ancient antiquities ancient churches or tried to. Sometimes Hezbollah and the Syrian Arab Army would be successful in defending those things. But there was a very much as a purposeful goal in destroying all this history. And now the new Al-Qaeda government is carrying that out. They're even taking up the Roman stones in the Christian quarter in Damascus and paving it over. They want no remnants of that type of history. Again, of a history and a present where people share and have kind of a more, for lack of a better word, kind of primitive socialism. And so we're going to lose all these antiquities, all this history, which should be very valuable to everyone. But that's the reality. That's what's happening.
I see it in very much the same way. I also see it as a springboard. You know, I see it as a springboard. I see it as, listen, the position of these countries is very strategic. You've got the Eastern Mediterranean all the way to Central Asia. You have Russia to the north. You have India, right, to the southeast. You have a lot of very important waterways like the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, right, the Suez Canal. You have the Eastern Mediterranean, which is fed into, which of course has, you know, the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles going up to the Black Sea. I think that this area is not only resource rich, it's rich in terms of its strategic position. And you saw that the recent conversation of Trump to take back Bagram Air Force Base from the Taliban was It's an hour away from where China is doing, you know, developing their nuclear weapons, right? From their nuclear facilities. That's the key. The key is that the control of the Eastern Mediterranean, the control of the Caspian, the control of these routes in Central Asia, the control of the Persian Gulf, the control of the Red Sea is critical for the maintaining of a hegemonic power and its power projection against other rivals. In this case, the BRICS, right? Russia, China, Iran, India to the southeast. You have Ethiopia as well, that's now in the BRICS, right? I just think that there's so much at play here. And it's not only about oil. It's also about the important, and as Dan rightfully pointed out, about basically violently bringing these people and countries into the capitalist world, which they are still, you know, they were still on the periphery. Now you really bring them in, right? Some of them had adopted socialist or socialist-minded style, governments. For example, the Ba'athist government in Iraq and Syria. You had a variety of socialist or nationalist projects.
Libya too.
Right. So now, violently bringing them in and exporting what America and Israel do best, which is extremism, to foment discord in the Caucasus region. A lot of Chechens, a lot of Dagestanis, a lot of people from the Caucasus are fighting in Syria. There's the East Turkestan Islamic Party, right? A lot of Uyghurs, over 2,000 are fighting in Syria. Where are they going to go after it's all over? Where are they going to go? They're preparing.
Well, I think that Tom has an idea. Here's another admission.
What incentive do they have to put their weapons down?
Zero. Zero. I mean, this is the problem, especially when Israel is attacking everybody. So if Israel is attacking Syria, Israel is attacking Lebanon, Israel is attacking Tunisia, as it goes on, their argument gets better and better, is we're here to protect the Lebanese from Israel. Israel has 5 points and is not withdrawing, but Hezbollah is rebuilding. The government has to take the responsibility. It's not our job. But they want Dwight Eisenhower to come. They want President Trump to be Dwight Eisenhower, land these beautiful Marines, and solve it all for them.
And that's not happening.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen anywhere. That's not our job. We're not doing that. We'll usher. We'll give our advice. We'll help. But they've got to solve it. So the Lebanese government, if they want to get back on track, has to say, we're going to disarm Hezbollah. They're scared to death that causes a civil war. Well, no kidding.
This is why we have to teach classes on how to listen and understand propaganda or what people are actually saying. So many things admitted in that like short 1 minute span. He admits that Israel will not withdraw. He admits that Israel has attacked the flotilla at Tunisia, which they argued against. He also, this comes after Barack went to Jolani and said, I need you to be a regional military. You mentioned the Uyghurs. You mentioned the extremists from the Caucasus. Then he says, this is going to cause civil war. Well, no kidding. So we're just, are we just planning on a civil war?
Well, that they would prefer that to having a strong government in Lebanon that could defend its own people. I mean, the Lebanese military does not defend the homeland. They don't defend anything. Hezbollah defends the homeland, right? That's why they want to get rid of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the only thing standing between Lebanon and the fate that Syria has faced. And already we see incursions into Lebanon from the new government of Syria in league with Israel. And again, without Hezbollah, Lebanon would have no chance of defending against that. So Lebanon is definitely on the chopping block. Of course, we know that, remember, from General Wesley Clark after 9/11 said there were seven countries the U.S. was planning on overthrowing, and Lebanon was one, Syria was one, Iran was one, Libya was one. I believe Somalia was on that list as well. And all that's coming to fruition. The other thing I want to say, you know, in addition to the things we've already enumerated, the other reason that chaos is the goal here of U.S. foreign policy, and it is.
It is.
And when you look at the results, I mean, time and again, that is what's happening in these countries where the U.S. has successfully intervened. They learned at some point that, right, for a long time, the U.S. would support these strong men to defend their interest in these countries, Mobutu in Congo, for example. And I'm going to stay with Congo for a second. But then even Mobutu started deciding, oh, I got to do something for my people or they're going to get rid of me. You know, so he started taxing some companies. He started, you know, some social programs. And the U.S. realized, you know, even the best strong man is unreliable. What we want is no government. We want total anarchy. And in that anarchy, we can totally exploit the people and the resources. So in Congo, they got rid of Mobutu. In 1996, Bill Clinton supported a world war against Congo. Remember that one? Yeah, no one knows about that. Where he supported 17 countries to go in and loot that country. And there really is no government that is governing Congo. And so what does that allow? There's no child labor laws. There's no environmental laws, no labor laws. And so you have companies able to exploit their resources without any opposition at all. And that is the model. The Congo is the model, and Syria is suffering that same model, Libya, Somalia. It is so reprehensible. And so when the U.S. says it wants to bring stability to the world, it actually wants quite the opposite.
Well, he admits that too. So here we go.
What's the end game?
I was hoping you weren't going to ask that because I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. Look, the end game, when we say peace, it's an illusion. There's never been peace. There will probably never be peace because everybody's fighting for legitimacy. The end result is somebody wants dominance, which means somebody has to submit. In that part of the world, submit, there's no Arabic word for submit. They can't wrap their head around submit. So eventually, prosperity is the only answer.
First of all, words in Arabic.
Why do they have to submit? Yeah, why is it that the Arabs have to submit? It's insane. But no, this is, and he can say this without tongue in cheek, because this is their ideology. They live in this, their own bubble of reality. They believe this stuff, right?
Islam literally means to submit.
Submit to Allah, right?
That's hilarious. Yeah. But it's just crazy. But why did, yeah, they don't have to submit to a earthly power.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Chris. Did you have something?
No, I think it's absolutely, like, isn't he from the region? Doesn't he have Lebanese roots?
I think he does, yes.
This guy is this is exactly what's wrong with
him. He's the same guy who called the Lebanese people animals, remember?
Remember? He was like, oh, come on, calm down, everybody. Hey.
You gotta act like animals.
Yeah, act like animals. Meanwhile, they're asking questions. He doesn't call the American reporters animals when they're hurling, you know, this, that, and the other in the press room. But I think that you really, there, Dan, we saw it. Peace is an illusion. There'll never be peace in the region. Therefore, we don't have to play by the peace game. Right. We just carry on our interests. That's
exactly
it.
Exactly. You
know? Yeah, war is inevitable in his view. Well, yeah, and it's inevitable because the U.S. is going to keep making war. I mean, that's,
exactly.
You know, 20 years ago, Syria, even by the U.S. State Department folks who – my friend Roger Harris is a good guy. He's a bird biologist, takes people all around the world. And he worked with the State Department folks for a time on their leadership program where they were taking emerging leaders to different countries. And he asked them, this was 20 years ago, what is the country that these folks most enjoy? And they said, to a person, Syria, because it is so peaceful, it is so placid, the people are so nice, and it's so historical. It was the U.S. that brought war and chaos and terror to that country and destroyed a very placid country that was a tapestry of many different religions, ethnicities. And you're seeing that being destroyed as we speak, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, peace doesn't exist because there's people in the world, many of whom are in Washington, D.C., who don't want peace. Peace is bad for business.
Speaking of no peace, business, and clown shows, it continued. The circus is still in town in New York City, but I highly recommend. So you got to dig for these things. This was on the Concordia YouTube channel. Check this out. The two of you are going to love it.
Please join again in welcoming President Ahmed Al-Shara to the stage. As you know, Mr. President, I spent over 37 years in the U.S. Army. And I was a soldier, not a diplomat. So I hope you'll forgive me if I speak with the directness of the old soldier that I am as I get the first question out of the way. Because the fact is that we were on different sides when I was commanding the surge in Iraq. You were, of course, detained by U.S. forces for some 5 years, including, again, when I was the four-star there. And here you are now as the president of Syria, which your forces liberated from the murderous Bashar al-Assad regime, to participate in your first UN General Assembly as the president of your country. Mr. President, I have some sense of how tough your job is right now, how much is riding on you personally, and I know you have to be keenly aware of that. The pressure has to be enormous. When people ask me, what was it like to command the surge in Iraq, I would respond by saying it was the most grinding experience of my life, but it was also the most important one. So this next one is about you personally. How are you holding up under all this pressure? Are you getting time to do some thinking? Are you getting enough sleep at night? Again, I've been there, and it is so very hard. And your many fans, and I am one of them, we do have worries. That gives you hope about your very challenging task.
I believe that my mission in Syria is much more difficult than yours in Iraq. It's a much more difficult in Syria than yours in Iraq, of course. In Iraq, it was limited. But Syria has faced a lot of destructions over the past years.
It's shocking. Of course, he doesn't mention that Al Jilani, because that's his nom de guerre, got his start in Iraq with ISIS.
Yeah, he just says you were detained. He doesn't say why.
Yeah, he was detained in a U.S. military base, and somehow he's released and with guns and money and goes into Syria.
Guns, money, trucks, everything.
Huh?
Guns, money, trucks, anything they needed.
And then he, you know, with the help of the West, becomes the president. I mean, it's incredible. Again, how did we go from there to Syria? Why doesn't anyone ask that question? Why isn't anyone asking? Again, 13 days after 9/11 in New York City, you have a guy who was head of Al-Qaeda in Syria, walking the streets, meeting with the, you know, ex-head of the CIA. I mean, it's really George Orwell would have nothing to write about today. I mean, it's just you don't need fiction. The reality just speaks for itself. It's insane, and that there's not major protest in New York against this guy.
There were trucks, but I didn't see any.
There are some very limited protests, mm-hmm. but you know, there's not the outrage one would expect. It really would be like having Osama bin Laden, you know, in his suit walking down New York City.
But he wants to know about his self-care. Are you engaging in enough self-care? Are you taking care of yourself?
Well, yeah, he is. I think, you know, they're kidnapping women and girls and raping them. And I guess that's his self-care, murdering Alawites, murdering Christians. I mean, again, no one discusses this. This is happening as we speak. I see reports of this every day coming out of Syria. This guy is a murderer. Even admits to being it. I mean, he admitted when he was younger, he was chopping people's heads off. And he says, well, that was kind of youthful indiscretion. You know, like in the West, you might drink or, you know, speed or something when you're a kid. And you might skip class. Well, I just chop people's heads off, you know.
It's a great pastime.
It's a great pastime. He had a $10 million bounty on his head up until early this year. And that was by the CIA because he was a terrorist. He really was and really is. And they just lifted it. The U.S. recognized him as the president of Syria, though he has no legitimacy. He said they're not even going to have elections for president for 4 or 5 years. Again, no one cares. It's incredible. Sometimes you just feel like everyone's on crazy pills, you know?
I have one last clip, and then you guys have the rest of the floor to take over. But this is another great whitewashing clip.
You know, in recent years, I was occasionally asked to assess the different groupings in Syria. And obviously, I assessed that the Islamic State and then Al-Qaeda, that they were not reconcilable. But when I was asked about the organization that you built, HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, I said, I actually believe that we could work with these individuals, that they were nationalists, certainly, yes, a degree of political Islam. But frankly, what you have done since toppling the Bashar al-Assad regime has validated what it is that I assessed it. And I was criticized, by the way, quite considerably. I just want to tell you, really, on behalf of all the people who are here, that this conversation has truly filled me with enormous hope. It has been very, very heartening and illuminating. Your vision is powerful and clear. Your demeanor itself is very impressive as well. And so, again, on behalf of all here and all those that are watching virtually and so forth, we thank you for sharing your vision today. We wish you strength and wisdom in the difficult work ahead. We obviously hope for your success, inshallah, because at the end of the day, your success is our success. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
I'm speechless. I mean, it's just incredible. It's just incredible. And what has he done since he's taken office that anyone could be proud of? Again, he's engaging in genocide on multiple fronts, doing nothing, by the way, to improve the economic life of the people, even though sanctions have been lifted. He's helping Israel take over more land of Syria. Mm-hmm. He's ceded the Golan Heights over to Israel. He's ceded parts of the north over to Turkey. He has done nothing to ask the Americans to leave the one third of Syria they're occupying. I mean, this guy's a disgrace. But that's what they want. They want a puppet. They don't care what his human rights practices are. They want a puppet that will help Israel do what they're doing. And that and he's carrying that out shamelessly. I don't know what to say. I mean, again, I guess we go back to that's why we wrote the book we wrote on Syria. So people understand how we got to this place and how it's not by accident. It was done on purpose. And as I cite in that book, I always tell people to read this article. This is a very prescient article from Seymour Hersh back in 2007 called The Redirection. He wrote it in the New Yorker magazine.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, and this was the beginning of the end for Seymour Hersh. Right now he has a Substack. Here's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He has a Substack because he can't get published anywhere in the West anymore. Because he wrote this article called The Redirection in 2007, in which he said by 2005, the Bush administration, which after 9/11, 2001, had declared a war on terror, which meant a war specifically on Al-Qaeda, had decided by 2005, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to actually now work with Al-Qaeda to overthrow governments in Libya and Syria and eventually Iran. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote in an article that really got him into hot water. I think it was called Red Lines and Rat Lines.
Oh, that's my article. That's like my favorite.
And that's what gets him booted out of really Western media for good. And what she talked about how after the overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011, the West helped bring jihadists and weapons from Libya to Syria to begin this war of terror against Syria. Mm-hmm. And again, go back and read those things because you'll see how everything that has happened has been predictable. The other thing we cite, of course, is the declassified document from the Defense Intelligence Agency, U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency from 2012, that said the U.S., the West was backing Al-Qaeda in Syria and that Al-Qaeda wanted to set up a religious caliphate. Well, that's what Al-Qaeda is doing now. Again, everyone knew it. Everyone who was paying attention knew that this was happening. But those of us who said what was happening were called Assadists and Putinists and everything else. But we were right. But I am not. I do not relish saying I told you so because too many people are suffering now from this reality. But the truth is, those of us who called this were right. But even now, people don't believe us, right? Even though they see it with their own eyes, they see the head of Al Qaeda meeting with Petraeus. They still don't see the truth.
Let me ask you, Dan, you've been in touch with people. I know that you have connections there, as I've maintained. What's going on the ground in Syria? What's going on, especially with the Alawites and the Christians who are beleaguered minorities in Syria now and face brutal repression? And there was basically an ethnic cleansing. It was basically a genocide, if you could put it that way, of these two groups of people over the past few months in Latakia, in Sueda, and other places where these roving gangs have just butchered people with really the tacit, if not outright approval of the government, including Jalani.
Yeah, thousands of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was there, you know, in January. I was there after Jalani took power. And the killings were starting then. In places like Homs, where I have Alawite friends, many of whom are living in fear. They won't even leave their house, not to go to the grocery store, not to go to school. Some are hiding in the woods. I have Christian friends in places like Malula who are begging me to help get them out of the country. the religious minorities are living in great fear. And very few people are happy with what's happened. You know, even many Sunnis, because they don't, even if they're Sunni, it doesn't mean they buy this extremist Wahhabism that's being pushed by the Al-Qaeda. And I know people personally who, at first, when Jilani took over, they were excited. They thought this was the beginning of a new Syria. And now they're like, I'm sorry, because we were wrong. Mm-hmm. This guy's crazy. What he's doing is crazy. Syria's dead. I mean, Syria's gone as a nation. I'm not saying it can't come back. I hope it does, inshallah, you know, that it will rise from the ashes. But Syria's lost. And for now, anyway. And I know few people that are happy about it. It's a very grave situation. It's a very dark time there. Very dark.
It is. I mean, I really, there's great concern for the Christians, the Alawites, the Druze.
Shia. Most of the Shia have left. Yeah.
It's interesting. When I was in Syria, I was offered Syrian citizenship for having fought against the terrorist forces, against Daesh. And now I think 600,000 people have had their Syrian citizenship canceled, most of whom are Shia or were involved, over the past decade plus in defending Syria, be they Russians, Iranians, Iraqis, people who came to defend at the request of the central government and were granted citizenship for them and their families. They've been canceled by Jilani because, of course, he said, we don't allow these groups of people. They're not true Syrian. What does that mean, true Syrian? They're not Syrian enough. Is it because of their religious identity? Is it because of which side they were on? But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a grave concern. And I want to get your thoughts on the Northeast, because there's a huge part, about a third of Syria, that is still not under the central government. It flies the same flag, but it's not under the control. What do you think is going to happen in the Northeast, in the area that some call Rojava, or the territories under the control of the Kurdish forces, the Syrian Democratic Forces, backed by the U.S.?
I don't know. I have a feeling they will break off from the rest of Syria. I don't think they're going to submit to this new government. Mm-hmm. But again, the question is whether the U.S. will leave that one third, you know. The U.S. shows no signs of leaving it. Remember, Trump said during his first term they wanted to stay to take the oil, and that's exactly what they're doing. So it won't even necessarily be up to the Kurds to decide their own fate there, you know?
Yep. Do you foresee, I want to get your thoughts, do you foresee the possibility of a state in Latakia, of like a separatist entity that could be for the Alawites, the Christians, and a sort of a refuge, just like maybe in the South Sueda might be for the Druze?
It's possible, but first of all, that like the Alawites that I've talked to don't want to break up Syria. They don't want a separate country. They want a federal system, which like the U.S., where you'd have maybe a state that's Alawite or mostly Alawite and Christian, you know, for some protection. But they don't want to balkanize it, you know.
Right.
But also, I don't think the government in Damascus will allow that. I don't think it will allow such a thing to exist, either a federal system or a separate, you know, nation state. They want a religious caliphate in Syria, and they're going to force people into it, even in Latakia and in Homs and in other Soweta, as you say, Malula, which is a Christian in Bedouin town. I don't think they'll allow it to happen. I think what you're going to see is that you're just going to see a mass exodus of Alawites, Christians, Druze. And that they're, you know, the new government will be happy with that. And it'll be a monolithic state for the first time in thousands of years, you know.
It's never been monolithic. That's the thing.
It's always been. The beauty of Syria is that all these people live together very happily.
Yeah.
All these different religions, ethnicities, and this new government will destroy that. They are destroying that.
Both of you, given all the whitewashing that we've watched throughout this entire episode, Trump's whitewashing of Gaza, Petraeus, Barack, how does that bode for Americans?
What do you mean?
Like, if they're willing to, like, doesn't it kind of show an upside down of what, them coming out in the open and just saying, there's no peace plan. Like, how does that bode for Americans given what's going on here? Just more war and more. Well,
I think so. Yeah, that is what he's saying. And I, interestingly, you had Trump who ran somewhat on a platform to end the forever wars. And I do think a lot of people voted for him because he promised that. He reneged on that promise as soon as he became president, right?
Mm-hmm.
But will people stand up and say, we're angry because you did that? We want peace. You know, I don't see it happening right now. We need a peace movement. And we need a peace movement that includes liberals and conservatives, which could be very powerful. You know, but at the moment, I don't see that. But yeah, basically, what you heard is that we're being promised war forever, despite the fact none of us want it. But they don't care what we want. They care what they want, and they want unlimited profits and control, and we're going to continue to be repressed, suppressed, and lose the few rights we have left. Sadly, I mean, unless there's resistance.
Yeah, do you foresee Israel taking more territory in Syria?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they're going to take more territory in Syria. They're going to try to take territory in Lebanon. Now, I mean, this is their last gasp. They think they have to create greater Israel now or never.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to try to do that. You know, I think they will be successful to some extent in Syria. I hope not in Lebanon, but they've already taken over parts of the south of Lebanon. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see if they go into Jordan or Egypt, which they also have designs on, even Saudi Arabia. But as the one guy said early in this program, I mean, he knows Israel's been attacking seven different countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so sadly, we're going to see more of that.
Let me ask you before as we start to wrap up. You and I went to the Donbass together. We went to Lugansk in May. I was in Donetsk and Mariupol. We went and saw frontline units. I want to ask you, where you see the situation today? A lot of things have changed since we went. We went under the Biden administration. We went before the election last year. We spoke at the UN. It was a different scenario, but it looks like we're getting back to a similar scenario again. Maybe not as overt in terms of the US support directly, but indirectly from what we're hearing from the Trump administration, selling any kinds of weapon systems to the Europeans and NATO countries to supply to Ukraine. Where do you see the special military operation? How long do you think this is going to go on? And what do you see as the ultimate conclusion in your opinion?
Well, yeah, I would have maybe answered the question differently a couple months ago. I mean, because I would have said that the war is probably about to end and that Russia would take the Donbass and parts of the East, you know, that voted to go with Russia. And the war would end on that basis. But yeah, now Trump has made it clear in the last day or so that the U.S. is going to double down on Ukraine. And Europe is made it clear they have no intention of backing off, and that they may be willing to have a war with Russia directly. I mean, sadly, I fear that's where we're headed, is with a direct confrontation between the West and Russia. I mean, again, I am not happy to say that, but that seems where we're headed. I think the capitalists know that they're in grave crisis. And they think the only way out is through a major war. I do think that, unless there's major political upheaval in the West, to demand that we not go down that road, I think we're headed towards a major conflagration with Russia. I mean, that's what I fear.
I agree, especially given Trump's recent tweet or Truth Social post. I think you both read it, right? That was. Yeah. Quite jarring.
Yeah, no, it's very scary. It's very scary.
And then both of you, what do you think? Because I asked Aria, my producer, the same thing. I said, Russia never responds really to statements, but I thought that statement was quite serious.
Yeah, well, you heard, I mean, the one thing I heard Putin basically, he basically double dog dared Trump to do it, to send more arms to Ukraine, you know, which also means that Russia is, I think they're preparing for the worst, too. I think they know that most likely war is coming in a very big way.
Listen, I mean, I'm here. As you know, I'm here in Moscow. And the talk on the town is that people were saying maybe another year or 2 years. I'm hearing now 3 to 4 years, and we're gonna drive. We're going to drive. We're going to keep moving. And there's going to be increase. There's a reserve, I was told. There's a reserve, troop formations that are building up, that are close in a few months to nearing 1 million soldiers. Yeah. So I think that the Russian Federation is prepared for a major ground offensive. And they are prepared to use even greater weapons. Let's be honest, Dan, you and I were there. The Russian Federation has not used its full firepower. In fact, it's used a fraction of its firepower because Putin's position, and I think the position of the Russian state, is that the people of Ukraine are brotherly people, right? They are part of the same nation overall. And so they have not done to the Ukrainians what the Zionists have done to the Palestinians in Gaza, right?
Right. And they have not wanted to do that. Yes.
And they have not wanted to do that. And they have not wanted to do that. However, at this point, in terms of attacking critical infrastructure and supply lines, logistics, armament supplies, and things like that, it looks like the Russian Federation is increasing. And now with drone production, I mean, there are estimates of 300 to 400 drones per day,
yeah,
can be launched against Ukrainian regime forces by the Russians. And that's going to increase over the next year or two as the capacity builds. I foresee that this, and of course, if that situation goes down that path, what sort of play do the Europeans have in your mind? What are the Europeans up to over there?
Yeah, I mean, they don't seem capable of taking on Russia. That's why this seems so insane. But and Germany, which is the one country that could mount some sort of true offensive, their economy's collapsing, you know, so I just don't know what these leaders are thinking. I don't know.
I lied. There's one more clip that just came out. It's a surprise for both of you. Guess who?
Okay.
Guess who restored diplomatic relations?
Good to see you.
Thank you for this meeting. 15 men, of course. Where we're ahead, we have today will resume our diplomatic relations.
Syria, Arab Republic.
So I was writing a really in-depth article about the Israeli-Azerbaijan-Ukraine axis, and I think I'm going to have to add Syria to that.
Yeah, well, and that axis has existed for a while. I mean, Ukraine has been helping with the foreign, you know, with the fighters in Idlib against Assad. Yep. And also the fighters in Idlib have gone to Ukraine to help the Ukrainians. So there has been a cross-pollinization going on for some time, which makes total sense. They're both pawns of the West, right?
They look alike.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You got the Nazis in Ukraine. You got the jihadists in Syria. And they've been bedfellows for quite a while. So, and with that, I must leave you, my good friend.
Yes, thank you. Everybody, please pre-order Dan's book. I did.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
The link is in the description. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan. Good to see you.
Definitely.
Great to see you both. Thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
That was great. I'm excited for the book.
Fantastic. Always great. Always great to have Dan on. Thank you so much again. And
we'll see you guys on Sunday.
We'll see you on Sunday. And of course, you know, just keep an open mind and try to get some sleep these days because
get some sleep. Petraeus is worried. Make sure you're all getting some sleep and engaging in self-care.
Are you feeling well? Like, I'm really concerned about
how are you holding up?
How's everything going?
I mean, you overthrew a legitimate president. Are you sleeping at night?
You killed
thousands of Christians and Alawites. Does it?
I mean, I thought at some point he was going to say, like, do you want to go on a date? Like, you know, your looks, you know,
I think you should have a spa day. A spa day. We're here in New York. We'll get you a blowout. We'll get you a spa day. Anyway, we'll see you guys on Sunday.
See you on Sunday. Lots of love to everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.